Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you doing?
You know, really, like, should we be asking these questions? Like, I probably spent show talking about what's gone wrong. Other than that, I'm fine.
Yes, no, I always ask the difficult questions, yeah, and we're also joined today by Mr. Michael Morris. Michael, how are you?
Well, thank you. Glad to be joining you both. Part of me identifies entirely with Terence's sentiment, but but yeah, we chin up and we face the front.
Indeed. And with that in mind, let's talk about our first story. And this just comes from Investigative Reporting, I think, by News 24 who did it. About the state of South Africa's Air Force, putting some numbers to what I think has been public knowledge now for a while, which is that the South African Air Force is not in great condition. According to this report, the South African Air Force has all but collapsed and has no fighting capacity left. It has only 6 operable military aircraft, and the other 325 aircraft are no longer in service. It says here, due to crippling cash shortfalls, this has left South Africa's soldiers who are, you know, deployed to various places, in particular the DRC deployment, completely without any air support or cover. It's one of the reasons why we suffered that catastrophic defeat at the hands of Rwanda. It seems because our Air Force is just not up to scratch anymore. Of South Africa's jets, 60 of them are awaiting major rebuilds. 3 have been discontinued due to age, or aircraft, sorry. 60 are awaiting major rebuilds. 3 are discontinued due to age. 27 are awaiting repairs. 6 are undergoing repairs. And 283 are grounded due to lack of spares. All of our 11 Rooivalk attack helicopters, which are a technological marvel, I think they were brought out in 1999, great piece of South African engineering, are currently not serviceable. Of our Oryx utility transport helicopters, we have 39. Apparently, only one is in service. Our Augusta helicopters, which I believe are used for support for the South African Navy, air support, rescue helicopters when carrying out patrols at sea, all of them are broken. All 4 of our Super Lynx 300 helicopters are broken. All 8 of our BK-117 helicopters are broken. Our very expensive Gripen fighter jets purchased in the arms deal from Sweden at great expense. We are one of the few countries in the world that operates these. We have 26 in total, only 2 operating. Incidentally, that seems to be the exact number that they need to do the occasional flyover of public events to show off. And I realized something was a bit adrift when during the State of the Nation address, I heard an SABC presenter ask a South African military official, where were the Gripen jets? And he said, they're not planned for today. And I thought, I wonder why. Of our Hawk trainer aircraft, of which we have 24, only 3 are operable. This is obviously a pretty big deal. This News 24 story makes the point that if we had those terrible floods somewhere in our neighborhood in South Africa, as happened in Mozambique back in 2000, there was that famous photograph of that woman who basically had to give birth in a tree because she was trapped by rising waters, and she and her baby were saved by South African pilots. The young girl who was born in that circumstance is a 24-year-old who's still alive today. Today, if that same situation occurred, South Africa would not have been able to rescue that person. And I think that is putting in human terms the sort of cost of a misfunctioning state institution like this. Never mind those 13 South African soldiers who were killed recently in the DRC, who one suspects may still be alive today, or maybe some of them may still be alive today, had we proper air support, had our Rooivalk attack helicopters been working correctly. Terence, let me start with you. You know, you always make the point that if you're going to have a military, it needs to work. What are your thoughts on this story?
Well, I don't think that we should broadcast my thoughts because this is a family show, and you know, I do think that the forum should be retained. Although this is not apparently a view held by a diplomatic corps, just saying. All right, so The deal is as follows. If each of those Hawk trainers was like training a pilot, there wouldn't be enough planes for them to fly after they graduated training. I mean, it just this is like, you know, it's beyond a crisis. It's to the point where you know, words fail me. I think we've touched on this a couple of times. Lack of military preparedness in Western Europe, but this is like next level stuff. You have a fairly sizable air fleet of 300 odd planes, but you can get, you know, single digits of them actually in the air. Helicopters, particularly for the kind of operations that South Africa is deployed in. If we had had those, if we had just ordered two of those Rooivalks, in the DRC, things could have turned out very differently. They pack a great deal of firepower over, I don't understand, like sort of 12 kilometers. You can start taking out the opposition.
And that's not just speculation. South Africa, in its previous deployment to the DRC against M23 and right. its Rwandan backers, was very successful in reversing the course of the conflict there. And we had our Rooivalk attack helicopters working back in 2013.
Yeah, no. In fact, just a couple of weeks ago, funnily enough, I was watching a Carte Blanche video on YouTube about the Rooivalk deployment in the DRC. No, look, I mean, South Africa is to all intents and purposes out of money now, and I think it's not taking its army seriously. It's not taking its military seriously. So I think this is a very real public debate. Let's shut the whole thing down. Let's take, you know, some of those some of the people in the military who could perhaps be repurposed as a kind of coast guard, you know, to ward off illegal fishing. Put, you know, maybe, you know, take some of the special forces and use them as a kind of what the French or the Italians call their gendarmerie or carabinieri, you know, like sort of special forces for building penetration. You know, there's something farcical about maintaining people in uniform if they can't do the job. You know, then you end up with the largest surrender of South African troops since Tobruk. Funny thing. Yesterday in City Press there was an article about how the army is looking to recruit. I don't know. It was like a certain number of white soldiers because white people are underrepresented in the lower ranks of the Defence Force. It's like, oh yeah, okay, great. You know, your spreadsheet says, you know, who needs to go where, but, you know, black, white, colored, Indian, when you're, you know, when you don't have your body armor and you don't have your gun and you don't have your Rooivalk overhead, you know, you'll all bleed the same color, and you'll discover that you're all in the same, you know, crock of SH !T as everyone else. I mean, that's actually good for nation building. We can all go down together, like they said on the Titanic. one of those airplanes that won't get off the ground.
Yeah, I went to the South African Naval Museum, History Museum in Simonstown recently, and it was a pretty nice museum. It's also got this sort of weird thing called the transformation exhibit, which is kind of like stapled on to the museum. I think it's entirely crewed by Navy personnel, so it's actually quite interesting. I recommend giving it a look if you are. You have some time in Simonstown, but they're the stories of the famous stories of the SS Mendi, a transport ship in the First World War, which was carrying black South African labor contingents off to serve in Europe during the First World War. And this ship got rammed by another ship and then proceeded to sink. And there's this sort of heroic tale, true story of the soldiers on deck. Kind of facing death together fearlessly without panic and kind of at attention. So Terence, you know, perhaps this is what you're suggesting, the SS Mendi formula for South Africa, that we can all go down together into the briny deep. But, you know, money is definitely a problem, right? Our defense force is underfunded, particularly for the capacity and the size that it's supposed to be. You know, we're supposed to be one of Africa's premier military forces, and that is just not the case. But when you see sort of 283 planes grounded for lack of spares, I do strongly get the feeling that this is not just a money problem. I very strongly suspect that there is a management problem and very likely also a corruption problem, which may be connected to why there is not enough money. Michael, what are your thoughts on the story?
I absolutely endorse all of what you and Terence have both said. I mean, I you know, running a military is a hugely, hugely expensive affair. You've got to be able to commit resources to it if you're going to sustain it. If you're not going to sustain it, as Terence perhaps wisely suggests, you've got to make that decision, a hard decision. You shut it down or you downscale it to what you can manage to retain. But there's no point in keeping this huge organization going if it can't do its job. And that's really the point we've reached. And I think you're quite right, Nicholas, that, you know, money is part of the problem. It is very expensive. But, you know, we aren't a massive military. We still have this huge army and Air Force Navy on the books. It's not massively huge, but it's got to be run properly. And if it's just too big for the money we've got to downscale that. But the main thing is we've got to manage the resources properly. And I think that's, as you say, this is what we're looking at. There'll be all kinds of arguments about, you know, the risk of militarism. I mean, would we be better off if we did have a huge, very effective army under the control of the present administration? You know, some people might say that this is not a desirable thing, but that's a different argument. You know, most of the function, or most of the actual activity of the South African Defence Force over the past, or defence, what is it called these days? The SADF is the old term.
National Defence Force.
There we go. I mean, it's essentially the same thing. But since, you know, at least the late 1990s, bar a few sort of militaristic seeming endeavours or associated endeavours, most of it is really civil. It's a civil assistance institution, and performs, you know, has performed really quite heroically in that sense. As you mentioned, Nicholas, the rescue of people in floods in Mozambique, it's part in a way of South Africa's influence and soft power in a way in the region. We can show, you know, that we do reach out a helping hand to neighboring countries if they need it. Terence has mentioned the countering illegal fishing and other activities off the coast. And that could include, I mean, these days, all kinds of organized criminal activity, drug trade, multi-billion dollar drug trade, which involves quite a bit of coastal activity. But, you know, and of course, rescues also, you know, this is also part of its function, just monitoring and looking after the interests of South Africans. But under present circumstances, this is just absolutely not possible. Where I sit, I mean, if there's a fire on Table Mountain, I can look right out of my lounge window here, and I can see all the activity with the various private helicopters and fire associated services, all sometimes for hours on end, or for days. Just recently, perhaps 4 or 5 days in a row, they would be constantly flying over and dropping water on the flames and with a spotted plane flying overhead. And I was watching this and I was thinking, you know, what a wonderful opportunity it would be for an effective military to be able to use things like this to keep their skills at a high level, to, you know, teach younger pilots and younger operatives how to work in tandem with other organizations. It's, you know, quite difficult conditions, often right up against the mountain, high winds and so on. But of course, there was no sign whatever of any of that because it's just not there. So, yeah, a great shame all around. The Defence Force can be much more of a service than its sort of military overtones might suggest. And at the moment, we just can't manage that. So it's a shame.
Yeah, no, I agree with that completely. And there is a lot of good work to be done. But I do think there is even some military work. We do have a dysfunctional autocratic state like Zimbabwe next door.
Yeah.
Who knows what it's going to be like in 5 years from now? I'm not saying Zimbabwe is going to invade us, but maybe they have some sort of internal conflict and it can spill over. Mozambique has been suffering through terrible civil conflicts recently. It's got that nasty insurgency in the north of Islamist radicals who are trying to take over the north of the country. And South Africa can't do much about it at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, there's no point in sending in infantry to these places if we're not going to have the advantage that our you know, equipment and technology gives us, which is what our air forces do. Terence, any final thoughts on this one?
Look, just to say that on the latter thing, the one advantage that conventional armies usually have over guerrilla forces is the ability to maintain elevation. So using helicopters. So for any conceivable threat that South Africa might face, that would be an integral part of it. But, you know, just to riff a bit on what Michael said, I think that if we are not going to keep the army fighting fit and equipped to fight, then by all means, you know, maybe keep the keep those assets, but, you know, demilitarize them. So use those helicopters to go and drop water and rescue people, and then turn, you know, their pilots into a sort of civil rescue organization. But this kind of like halfway house where, yes, you know, we might send you off to fight with equipment that doesn't work is unfair to them, and it makes us a laughing stock.
Yeah, exactly. All right, let's move into our next story. And this is probably, I think, the last time we're going to hear much in public about, I guess, now former ambassador Ibrahim Rasool, who we covered relatively recently, was ejected from the U.S., after some comments he made about United States President Donald Trump. On his return to South Africa, he did this weird sort of, I don't know what to call it, rally, press conference thing. I think it was in Cape Town. It was a welcome home ceremony or something. I'm not quite sure what the point of this is. But anyway, at said thing, he kind of, well, let's just say that he was unrestrained in expressing his feelings. Perhaps most worryingly, he said that while Cyril Ramaphosa should replace him as ambassador to the United States, that President Ramaphosa doesn't mean that Ramaphosa should appoint a white ambassador for a white president in the United States. So what a wonderful parting gift from the former ambassador after his stellar service to the South African Republic. Terence, what do you make of these comments?
Yeah, today the president in his letter to the country said we mustn't allow foreign affairs to divide us or whatever. There. You know, white president, white people. Ooh, those dreadful white people. Yeah, you know, it's not about so much allowing it, as this seems to be the sort of almost a stock response. What did Marco Rubio say when he kicked him out via Twitter? Okay, which I'm also more wild about, you know, because I think the social media thing is out. Yeah,
he said something like, "Yeah, race-based politicians." It's like, well, way to prove the point there.
No, it proves that ineptitude does not stop on the runways of our now grounded air force. It extends all the way to the corridors of our embassies. No, it's truly depressing.
Your thoughts on this one?
I just want to mention, I mean, in our chat before the show, you know, that what he's handed a really poisoned chalice to Ramaphosa, because whichever way Ramaphosa now goes, he's going to be perceived to have caved in to one side or the other and not been able to, you know, make a sensible decision about South Africa's diplomacy. And Ramaphosa has actually, I mean, in recent, the presidency in recent days, being, as Terry says, you know, emphasizing the need for calmness. We don't want to damage this important relationship. I'm sure Ramaphosa would very happily go off and make some deal, whatever deal is required with Donald Trump. And that's fine. You know, diplomacy is, you know, the business of extracting advantage for your country. which Rasool completely misunderstood. But it is terrible that he returns. Forget about the difficulties the ANC and the president now faces. It's just as Terence emphasized, it's this divisive race baiting kind of thread that goes through all these things, which is completely wasteful. And I think back to, I can remember a very interesting occasion covering a visit that Ibrahim Rasool made as he was Western Cape Premier at the time, to Indonesia, to a place called Makassar in South Sulawesi. And in fact, there's a suburb in Cape Town called Makassar, which is named after that area. And and a lot of the people who came to South Africa and involuntarily, as either as slaves or in fact quite a few as political prisoners, came from that neck of the woods. But he was invited to speak, I think it was to accept perhaps, it might have been an honorary doctorate or an award given to Mandela, but on Mandela's behalf. And in his address, that I was sitting there in the audience covering this, he said that that Muslims elsewhere in the world would be surprised, perhaps, if we should pay attention to the fact that in South Africa, the human rights basis of the constitutional order meant that they were more secure and their dignity and their rights were acknowledged to a greater extent than even in Islamic or Muslim-dominated society. So, and I think back to that, what a contradiction, what a contamination of that idea to come out now in 2025 and speak in these divisive terms. It really is just, it's very telling, unfortunately. I mean, that's the sad part of it. After all this time, when most South Africans have really got over all this stuff, the ANC finds that this is a convenient means to drive a wedge, to use leverage of some sort at this pretty base level. It's a great pity.
So,
very much.
One thought that occurs to me of this, Terence, is that it really kind of seems to me as though the ANC can't even sort of have, kind of coalesce around its own strategy. On one side, it's continuing to sort of be the kind of boring look at saying, look, we're just trying to mend the relationship. We're going to go and explain to the Americans our position. We're not going to be bullied, but then they don't mention who we're being bullied by. And they're playing it quite close to the chest. It's very kind of like staid and calm. We're not going to retaliate for Rasool. We're not going to kick out the American ambassador when he is appointed. That's kind of the tone coming from government. And at the same time, you've got the other half of the ANC running around declaring, that this is the great revolution in world affairs, and we are speaking truth to power. And it seems like even the ANC can't get on the same page for this one. I know party discipline is not a thing the ANC is renowned for, but really, this is like scraping the barrel.
This is, I think, advanced political sclerosis. It's an organization that's kind of out of ideas. That's presided over a litany of collapses. In fact, just a couple of weeks ago, I was speaking to somebody whom I was at university with and who was very much on the ANC's page, and said that there's probably not a metric where ANC governance has been successful, sadly. You've got a party that I don't think you've got an organization that I don't think ever kind of resigned itself to being a political party and being a government. It was everything else, it was transformation, not governing. It was revolution, not politics. And also Tony Leon actually made an interesting point about the idea that the ANC and the state as far as foreign policy goes, it's a distinction without a difference. So, and this is something that's been pulled up repeatedly over the last couple of years over Russia and whatever. No, that's the ANC. We're the South African government. But I don't think there's any part of the state that is more bound up with the ANC sort of ideological agenda, not even education or health or anything like that. This, I think, has attracted a particular vintage of ideologue. This is the real deal. This is where we can carry on being what we were in the 1960s.
What was the comment that was
a revolution?
Yeah, what was a comment made by one of our colleagues in our morning meeting today? Apparently, the ANC is telling other parties in the GNU that appointing the new ambassador to America is a government matter, not a government of national unity matter.
And you wonder why this is a bad day.
So let's finish off our bad day with Michael, the column that you wrote recently on the ANC's lack of vision for a brighter South Africa. Now, you know, critical as one may be of the ANC, I think you could argue that in the 90s and in the 2000s that they did have a much sort of stronger sort of claim to say this is what we want South Africa to be, but that there's just sort of no juice left whatsoever in that tank. The economy isn't growing, crime is up, 100 metrics you can look at, increasing dependence on pittances of social grants. There's so many metrics you can now look at to just say that South Africa is not heading in the right direction. Would you like to talk about your column?
Mm. It's actually published today in Business Day. And I drew, in fact, on two posts by ex-posts by former colleague Gareth van Onselen, great liberal, South Africa, very outspoken, very muscular and vigorous, and an extract, a small extract from a speech by Constitutional Court Judge Justice Jody Colopin. So I'll begin with the Gareth van Onselen ex-post, which I think appeared maybe a week and a half ago. And it's simply this. This is probably a stupid question. It is so obvious, and yet I don't know the answer. Why does the ANC not just do better? Grow the economy, fix education, address crime, care about service delivery, etc. Surely it would be the biggest beneficiary of this. What is the downside? So, you know, it's a very good question. The quote from Justice Colopin's lecture, it was a human rights lecture at the 18th Human Rights Lecture at Stellenbosch University, I thought was very telling because it sounds absolutely plausible and rational in the way that so much of the rhetoric and the narrative of the contemporary society goes. But I think it contains this quite interesting contradiction. He begins by saying, today, no one can explain the longevity of apartheid. And he then goes on to say, as we would all agree, in time, future generations will ask, how could a society with a history such as ours, armed with the constitution that we have and acutely aware of the dire consequences inequality and poverty hold for the future, have allowed poverty and inequality to endure for so long? And, you know, the contradiction is between his beginning by saying no one can explain the longevity of apartheid, and then he goes on in a sense to explain why, and it's because not of the history of apartheid, but the history since apartheid, the past 30 years. And the second quote that I use from the second post that I use from Gareth van Onselen is this one, that and it's, you know, as forceful as he always is. He says, the fundamental problem with policy analysis in South Africa is that no matter the issue, no matter the scale of the problem, no matter the funding problem, if you are at all interested in a better tomorrow, there's only one real primary policy position you can hold. The ANC must go. And it's really the difficult, you know, the piece is really in a sense about South Africa's difficulty in just confronting this basic thing. We always try to, you know, say nobody can explain why apartheid's, the effect of apartheid is lasting so long, and what are the problems? Why we've got implementation issues, we've got management issues, and this, it's really quite simple. We just have a tired political party that I think Terence is saying, but Elias run out of ideas, and it just cannot actually manage this anymore. You know, it confuses the government of national unity with government itself. I mean, that's such an elementary thing. But it does demonstrate the terrible weakness now at the heart of this thing. And its inability.
An ANC supporter once said, you know, you can only judge us in government after we've had enough, you know, time, as only when we've had enough time in power as the country was taken to be messed up. But of course, he didn't say since apartheid, he said since basically colonialism. So he said we need 300 years before you can determine how good we are, and which is such garbage. Because if you look all around the world at countries that have been in worse positions than us often, that have turned themselves around to become, in some cases, more successful or at least approaching more successful, that it has been done in shockingly short amounts of time. You know, major social transformation, whether you're looking at Japan in the 1800s, whether you're looking at, you know, it's like Vietnam or Indonesia today, whether you're looking at India or China, you can have absolute Ireland is another good example, actually. It was a very dysfunctional country until relatively recently. These are places where the once the right policies were adopted, the change in the society came within a few decades and was noticeable within years, not within centuries. So the idea that, you know, as has been pointed out here, that we just, you know, we sort of can't, or it's too big a task, is just rubbish. We've just not taken the right approach. Terence, final thoughts for today?
Yeah, look, I would just like to point out that Mr. Colopin, or Judge Colopin, in his career has rather been associated with this idea that this is all inexplicable because we have this constitution or whatever. He was a head honcho at the South African Human Rights Commission, which, you know, a constitution can and perhaps should guarantee all these things, but you need resources to do them. You need to give people the space to actually to take advantage of that. You need to hold people accountable. And I'm sorry to say, but bodies like the Human Rights Commission were in the vanguard of pushing pushing the sort of race consciousness that I think is manifested in many of the pathologies. I remember going back to about 1996, Barney Pityana, who was the first the first chair, recommending that we needed to train people to use racial frames of analysis. This is like just after we voted it out. It was like, and they were going to be conducting racial audits on, you know, well, the rest is history. You know, we're now sitting at a point where we've reintroduced racial. Well, we've introduced racial quotas. Sorry, you know, and that is why we are. Well, that's one. Well, certainly one of the reasons why we are where we are.
No, exactly.
Sad, very sad.
Well, why do we do this podcast every day? In the hope that we will equip our listeners and perhaps interested people who are not sure what they think yet, with the tools and the arguments and the knowledge to go out and put pressure on society, on government, on all these institutions to start changing South Africa for the better. And that's a not always a process that happens quickly. I often say that South Africa is a country that has arguably never been governed well at any point in its history since 1910. And yet we're sort of still standing. And I think that does speak to the kind of resilience of South Africans and our ingenuity, despite our governments very often. But yes, anyway, I think that is all the time we have for today. We've gone a little bit long, but thank you very much for listening. We hope you found the show interesting. We'll see you all tomorrow on the Daily French Show. Cheers, everyone.